Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 2nd of July. We talk about Iran, Israel, and the United States the first hour of our program today. According to a report from ABC News this week, Israel is increasingly likely to attack Iranian nuclear facilities this year. And there's a lengthy article by Cy Hirsch in the current issue of The New Yorker saying that military and civilian leaders in the Pentagon share the concern of the White House about Iran's nuclear ambitions, but there is disagreement about whether a military strike is the right solution. Some Pentagon officials believe, Cy writes, as they have let Congress and the media know, that bombing Iran is not a viable response to the nuclear proliferation issue and that more diplomacy is very necessary. Joining us this hour is a person who knows this part of the world very, very well. We're speaking this hour with Professor Hilary Mann Leverett. She is Chief Executive Officer of Strategic Energy and Global Analysis, which is a private consulting firm based in the Washington, D.C. area. And they provide clients with cutting-edge assessments of political risk in global energy and financial markets. She spent 15 years working for the National Security Council at the White House and the State Department. She was director for Afghanistan, Iran, and Persian Gulf Affairs, and associate director for the Near East at the State Department. She was Middle East expert for the Secretary of State's policy planning staff and political advisor on the Middle East, Sudan, and Central Asia at the U.S. mission to the United Nations. She was one of a small number of U.S. officials authorized to negotiate directly with senior Iranian officials over Afghanistan, al-Qaeda, and Iraq, and she has served in the U.S. embassies in Egypt, Israel, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. She is a graduate of Harvard Law School and has written frequently for many publications about this part of the world, so she's the perfect guest for this hour. We're welcoming phone calls. I know that many of you have concerns about this issue, which is slightly under the radar. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. If you'd like to join us by email, that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And Hilary, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's just start with the initial question here. Is it, would you agree with this Defense Department official that Israel is increasingly likely to attack Iranian nuclear facilities this year?
Well, I think the Israelis are increasingly concerned that the Iranian nuclear problem, which they see as essentially an existential problem to the existential threat to the state of Israel, that will not be dealt with decisively militarily by the Bush administration in its remaining days in office, and potentially not by the next administration in its first year in office. This is a fundamentally different strategic picture for the Israelis that they were in compared to a year ago, when they think they had expectations that the U.S. would deal militarily, decisively with this problem. And today they don't have that kind of assurance, so their urgency is increased, I think.
Mm-hmm. And do we have specific information, good intelligence on this? Because I've heard conflicting reports about how large the nuclear threat is right now.
Well, the U.S. and Israeli intelligence agencies for years have actually had, I think, a friendly disagreement about exactly what would constitute the threat or actually even constitute a nuclear program from Iran. Let me just explain briefly. For the U.S., we see the threat as Iran producing a weapons program, actually producing nuclear weapons that could target either the U.S. or our allies, including Israel. For the Israelis, they see the threshold as actually coming before that, coming before weaponization. They see the threat as crossing a red line for them when Iran has the knowledge to produce a nuclear program that could, at some point, become a weapons program. Now, there are other countries around the world that we don't really see as a threat who have that kind of option, the Canadians, the Japanese. They all have a program that could, they have the knowledge for a nuclear program that they could weaponize if they determined they needed to, probably within 6 months to a year after they made that kind of determination. For the Israelis, it's having the knowledge, not the actual weaponization program. So when you hear the different time frames for when a program would constitute a nuclear program in Iran would constitute a threat. That's where you see, that's where some of the discrepancy lies between when the Iranians acquire the knowledge, everything they need to know to go to mm-hmm. have a weapons program, versus when they actually weaponize. So there are two different tracks there with two different time frames.
What do you know about the covert operation that Cy Hirsch wrote about in the New Yorker this week, with Congress agreeing to the request from the administration to fund a what's been described as a major escalation of covert operations against Iran, highly secret, it sounds like. Do you know what those activities are?
Well, at this point, I think it would be impossible for anybody who has very accurate knowledge to be able to discuss it publicly. What I can do is draw on previous experience and how things like this operate.
Okay.
For there to be a presidential finding, which is what Cy Hirsch wrote about in The New Yorker, is a very significant step up in covert operations that would be run by the CIA. It's different than some of the kind of military activities, intelligence-related military activities that our military might do in and around Iraq, potentially as part of our operations in Iraq. You know, the Iranians are active in Iraq, and there could be an argument that the U.S. military does need to do some sort of intelligence activity dealing with that, with the military situation inside Iraq. But that's one level. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of understanding that probably the U.S. has been doing that for quite some time in Iraq and then cross-border from Iraq. And that's militarily oriented, would be run through the Defense Department, and doesn't require this extra set of congressional scrutiny and funding approval. The Defense Department would have it within their purview to just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it has that actually especially within its purview to do it under this administration, who has made a particular issue of the prerogatives, the privileges of the executive branch, including the military, to do what it needs to do as part of what it sees as its mission. For the intelligence agencies, for the CIA, to actually run covert operations like this that could include the use of lethal force, funding groups that might be considered terrorist groups by other countries or even by us, that type of activity, whether it's the use of lethal force with those groups or conducting intelligence operations outside of the military theater of Iraq, that would require this extra level of congressional scrutiny and funding. So Cy writes about it with some precision, which I think should give everyone great pause to think that this is something that could actually be happening. We saw this happen in terms of seeing it before. We saw this in the 1990s. In 1994, it was a Democratic administration under President Bill Clinton, but it was a Republican Congress. The Republicans had just taken control of Congress, and they allocated money for what they called at the time pro-democracy programs, but they also included an intelligence component. The Iranians took that as a very significant provocation, but even really a casus belli. And from my understanding from the Iranians and from others, this contributed to the decision-making in Iran to eventually put in place some of the terrorist operations we saw in the 90s, like the attack on the U.S. housing complex in Khobar, Saudi Arabia, the Khobar Towers bombing
mm-hmm.
in 1996 that killed 19 U.S. servicemen. So the Iranians reacted to it, and the potential danger we have today is that this story does seem to be have some credibility to it. But regardless of whether it does or not, the Iranians are increasingly anxious and increasingly preparing to strike back against both the U.S. and Israel for what they see as significant provocations mm-hmm. and potential casus belli.
And how could they strike back? In what form?
Well, they have, I think the easiest thing for them to do today would be to strike back against us in Iraq. There's been a lot of discussion about the Iranians not behaving very well in Iraq and giving the green light for some weapons to come into Iraq, training of some of the Iraqi militia groups. But overall, knowing Iranian behavior and what they're capable of, I think they've actually been incredibly restrained in their ability to hurt us inside Iraq. They could, without that much difficulty, cut off some of the vital supply lines for our supplies coming from the Persian Gulf, from Kuwait going up to Baghdad. They have a pervasive presence throughout Iraq that they could deploy to really target, hurt, and kill U.S. soldiers and civilians inside Iraq. We have 150,000 soldiers in Iran, the Iraqi battle theater. all of them would be vulnerable to a massive Iranian presence right next door. There are 80 million Iranians right next door. So we would have our 150,000 troops essentially vulnerable to that kind of attack. And that's just in Iraq. The Iranians have intelligence networks that are trained really to case U.S. and other, including Israeli, facilities worldwide, from Afghanistan and Lebanon to Latin America, places where we wouldn't necessarily expect that they have a network, but they do. They have a worldwide network that they could deploy. And it has been set up precisely for this reason, to protect the regime against what it sees as potential attacks, particularly by the U.S. or Israel.
And tell me a little bit more about this finding. Did Congress have to sign off on this? Who was briefed on all of this?
Well, the briefing, the requirements for the briefing essentially are what they call the Gang of Eight, which are the top Republican and Democratic leaders of the Congress, both on the Senate side and the House side. So there you would have the top two from the Senate, the Republican and the Democrat, the top two from the House, the Republican and the Democrat, that would be four. And then you'd have from the two intelligence oversight committees in the Senate and in the House, the top Democrat and Republican. So that would add another four. And those are the eight people. So in terms of this being a highly secret process, it is, because if it leaks, essentially the leak has to have come from within the administration, who would have briefed the Congress, these congressional eight figures, or from one of the eight figures themselves or a very close staff member who would be cleared to receive the information. Not the entire staff that works, let's say, for Harry Reid, for Senator Reid, would not be briefed on this program. But he would have one person who would be cleared to be briefed on something so secretive. And it would be the same for the other eight members of the House or Senate. So it's a very small group. So in terms of this getting out, it had to be someone from within the administration, either at the White House, the Defense Department, or the CIA, and or one of these eight members of Congress or their particular staff person who has been cleared to receive this kind of briefing.
And according to the article in The New Yorker, there was some concern about this. Some legislators troubled, he writes, by the aspects of the finding, a significant amount of high-level discussion about it. But still, the funding for the escalation was approved, considering the fact that the Democrats were elected in the midterm election to kind of change the course here. Why did they say sign on to this?
That's a very good question. I left the administration. I had very serious problems with the decision to go into Iraq in 2003, and became increasingly concerned that I could not support this administration's policies. Unfortunately, I'm not partisan, not a Republican or a Democrat. I've worked for both Clinton administration and the Bush administration, and wanted both of them to succeed. But unfortunately, the mistakes, I think, that we've made going into Iraq and our Middle East policy, war and terror policy more broadly, these have been mistakes that maybe President Bush took them to the highest level of being problematic, but they were enabled, I think, by many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, Democrat and Republican. And many of these problems were not They were, I think, made much worse by the Bush administration, but some of the basic problems were also in place during the prior Clinton administration. And so I think there has been a tremendous hesitancy by many members of Congress, including the Democrats, to actually take a stand and to oppose something that they either see that the intelligence doesn't support what the prospective course of action is, or that the prospective course of action, like this kind of covert operations program or potential military campaign against Iran, that even with the threat that I think people might see, that the answer is not a military answer. And you've seen, I think, the Democrats as well, unwilling to really take that on and propose a really coherent alternative to dealing with many of these threats militarily.
So the other storyline is that the Israelis are planning to do this while Bush is still in office, fearing that a Democratic administration may not go along with this. Is there any validity to that?
Yeah, I think the Israelis' the concern is actually a bit bipartisan. It comes out potentially most focused on the concern that candidate Senator Obama may not support military action because of his proposal, his idea to actually meet with, meet with and discuss and engage diplomatically with problematic states, including Iran. So I think they're concerned about that. But the concern is also for McCain, that even if McCain, the Republican candidate McCain, decided that a military option against Iran would be useful and could give a green light to the Israelis, that it will take a long time for that to happen. There will be a transition period, not only between the election in November and the inauguration in January, but then once McCain, if it were McCain who were elected, took office in January, there could be at least a six-month transition for him to have his major appointments vetted and approved by Congress, and then for those people to come into office and to actually do a review of policy and see what makes sense. So you could be talking another year, even under a McCain administration, who potentially the Israelis could see as much more sympathetic toward military option. Even if that were the case, you're still looking at a significant delay. So for the Israelis, it comes back to this basic question. They thought that, I think many of them thought, not all of them, but many in the national security establishment in Israel, expected that the threat could be dealt with decisively by this administration. If that doesn't happen, they're now looking at this potential 1.5 to 2 year window where nothing may be done, where policy could be adrift, and the Iranians could continue to produce a nuclear weapons program, even if it's not weaponized, and that's the threat that they see. So I'm not sure that it's something that depends particularly on having a sympathetic Bush administration as much as it does that they're concerned that there would be this window where nothing would be done on Iran for a year and a half or 2 years, which they see as a dangerous vacuum.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Hillary, and we'll take them in just one moment. Hillary Mann Leverett is Chief Executive Officer of Strategic Energy and Global Analysis based in Washington, D.C. Prior to that, she spent 15 years working for the National Security Council at the White House and the State Department in both the Bush and Clinton administrations. She was Director for Afghanistan, Iran, and Persian Gulf Affairs on the National Security Council and Associate Director for the Near East at the State Department, Middle East expert for the Secretary of State's Policy Planning Staff and Political Advisor on the Middle East, Sudan, and Central Asia at the U.S. mission to the United Nations. Our phone number, our lines are all busy, but keep trying. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee, or send an email if you want to go that route. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Wednesday, the author of From Baghdad to America, Life Lessons from a Dog Named Lava. All right, let's go to phone calls for Hillary, and we start today with Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for the guest. At the beginning, you said that this was under the radar, and it should be absolutely on everybody's radar because I think it's the most important event that's going to happen in the next 6 months. From my perspective, I think there's no doubt that the Israelis are going to strike. Historically, they've done it twice before under much less threatening conditions for them. From their perspective, every day that goes by, there's two things that can happen. Obviously, the Iranians are getting closer to having the capability, but there's also another problem that the Iranians are close to acquiring a missile defense system, a surface-to-air missile defense system, which could complicate the things for the Israelis. So they're going to go in before that system is up and running. So it really doesn't matter what any of us think, Obama, McCain, or me or you or anybody. It's the important thing is what the Israelis think, what they perceive as a threat that is, they've got the 45 pointed at their head, and they're going to do what has to be done. Consequence of this is that probably the Iranians will try to do something in Iraq. They'll probably try to shut down the Strait of Hormuz. If that happens, we're probably looking at, petroleum going to $300-$400 a barrel for a short period of time, but it's going to happen. And my concern is, what are we doing to prepare ourselves for what is inevitably going to happen? Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Hillary.
The caller makes a few very, very important points. The point about the Iranians acquiring this Russian missile system is an important one and does change the strategic picture for the Israelis, in addition to the other variables that I laid out. So that is something that will affect the Israeli strategic decision-making over the next 6 months. I think a difference for the Israelis, though, that comparing a potential military strike against Iran compared to the two that the caller referenced, those were two strikes the Israelis carried out. One was in the 80s against the Iraqi nuclear facility in Ozerak, and the other was just this past September in Syria. For both of those, there was in both of those scenarios, what was a potential repercussion from the Iraqis or the Syrians, potential blowback to the Israelis or to the U.S., was much, much less. We didn't have 150,000 U.S. soldiers there. And not only is the U.S. a good ally for Israel, but Israel, I think, does try to think of itself as a good ally for the U.S. So to put 150,000 Americans in striking, at risk of being attacked is something the Israelis are going to think twice about compared to the their previous attacks on both the Iraqi installation and the Syrian installation. The other difference here is that there is actually a difference within the Israeli national security establishment in terms of how to deal with Israel. I think for the when they looked at the Iraqis, they just thought Saddam Hussein was Hitler-like, and there wasn't any difference. He was a complete dictator and authoritarian, totalitarian, had total control of the system, and there wasn't really another way to look at or deal with the Iraqis. For the Iranians, the way the Israelis see it, there is potentially a way to deal with the Iranians. The Israelis had a very cooperative relationship with the Iranians prior to the overthrow of the Shah in 1979. They had a diplomatic relationship. They had an intelligence relationship. There continue to be some Israeli ties to some Iranians. And there is some idea that there could be a kind of grand bargain achieved with Iran, similar to how the U.S. Reconciled with China under the Nixon administration and completely changed policies. And today our relationship with China isn't perfect, but it is certainly much better in a strategic sense. So there is, I wouldn't say a dominant view in Israel, but there are some in the Israeli national security establishment that think you can actually deal with the Iranians in a different way that would deal with Israel's strategic concerns. But the fear that I have is that the next 6 months, in particular, you may see people in Israel, as well as some of the allies here in the United States, concerned that there is an immediate existential threat being posed by Iran's acquisition of the knowledge necessary for a nuclear program. And that's where I think the real danger is this kind of short-term fear by some in the Israeli establishment, some here in the United States, that may lead people to make a very hasty, reckless decision that I think, as the caller pointed out, in terms of repercussions for the price of oil, for our energy security, right, for our troops in the region, for stability in the Gulf, is a very serious one.
And what's your perception? Is this an Israeli planned event? Could this not happen without getting some kind of help from the United States? Is it a joint venture, but our end of it is more covert?
That's an excellent question. For the Israelis to hit some of the sites in Iran, and they couldn't hit all of the sites and actually completely destroy the program. The best they could do is disrupt the program potentially for a few years. But even to do that, the Israelis would have to traverse somebody else's airspace. Iran is not a direct neighbor. And so the critical corridor, the most efficient, useful, focused corridor, airspace corridor the Israelis would have to attack some of these sites in Iran would be over Iraq. We control Iraq's airspace 100% of the time.
I see.
So for the Iranians, whether or not this was a coordinated, pre-planned partnership decision between the U.S. and Israel, the fact that the Israelis would be using U.S.-controlled Iraqi airspace will make it tantamount to a joint exercise. Mm-hmm. And you can make a similar, though less compelling argument, but still very similar, if the Israelis decided to use Turkish airspace or Saudi airspace, two very important U.S. allies. And for the Iranians, they've said publicly now, their foreign minister has said publicly, the head of the Revolutionary Guard has said publicly that an Israeli attack, precisely because of these reasons, would be seen as not just an Israeli attack, but a U.S. Israeli attack.
James from Mineral Point. Hi, James.
Hi. Thanks for the guest. Very interesting. And I think she's right on point. I'm from a military family. I've had my two boys in the military. My daughter's been in the military. My brother was in Vietnam, so we're proud of the flag. But I think this group in there now is the most stupid, arrogant, ill-advised group of people that I've ever seen in my lifetime. I'm 72 years of age. If you had a covert activity by Iran into this country to disrupt this government, what would we think? I mean, it's just one bad move after another. We're fighting the war on a credit card. Our debt right now is costing us about $400 billion a year just on the interest alone. And if this erupts in Iran, you're going to have our grandkids and my children is going to be involved in this thing. There's going to be a draft if there's a war over there. I've never seen this country so screwed up in my life. And I'll just take the answer off the air.
Thank you, James. Mm-hmm.
The caller, I think, makes two really, really important points. One, you know, comparing it to what if the Iranians initiated such a program against the U.S., whether it was a covert program or sanctions against the U.S. or a threat of a military strike, if you had Iranian officials actually threatening publicly to strike militarily either the U.S. or Israel, if you could just imagine what the U.S. or Israeli response would be, it certainly, certainly should give everyone pause. The idea, what concerns me often is that, particularly from my experience in the Bush administration, there doesn't seem to be an understanding that the Iranians might react to the rhetoric that we use and to the actions and programs that we try to implement. The idea that the Iranians are just going to sit there while we're implementing a covert program against them with using intelligence assets, or they're going to just sit there and continue to be happy about increasing economic sanctions, or they're going to sit there and not plan militarily against a potential U.S. or Israeli military strike. The idea that the Iranians aren't going to plan is pure fantasy and does need to seriously be taken into account. The other thing I think that is critically important that the caller raised is that we're fighting this war on a credit card. The whole war on terrorism essentially is being fought on a credit card now, and particularly the war in Iraq. But then if we did have a military attack on Iran, that certainly would be fought on a credit card. The Iranians, you know, when we went into Iraq, the price of oil was about $30 a barrel. I think yesterday it went up to $143
right.
a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, every time there's more speculation about a military attack, every time we try to look at that as a credible option, all it does is undermine our own energy security, makes it more expensive not only to buy gas here, but really puts us on a course for potentially other conflicts dealing with energy down the road. We need to really fundamentally rethink the way that we look at Iran. Iran is not just a bad little child, behaving badly that needs to be punished and eventually brought in to see the light of day and be a democracy and act in ways the U.S. wants. Iran is a mature country, thousands of years of history, a critically important geostrategic role, critical for energy security for the U.S., for the entire planet, and really is an important country for U.S. national security interests, similar to, and I go back again to the example, of when Nixon went to China in the 1970s. Iran may not be as populous or as important today as China is, but it does present the same kind of geostrategic nexus in terms of U.S. national interests that are important. We need to have an important strategic relationship with Iran that brings all the benefits that Iran potentially could offer into a relationship with us and allows us to manage and deal with the difficulties and challenges they pose by some of their tactical choices.
We have an email from Al from Milwaukee. Russia is much, much closer to Iran than the U.S. Why aren't the Russians worried about this? They obviously aren't if they're going to supply an advanced air defense system. Maybe we're being told lies in order to get us to do Israel's dirty work for it the way we did in Iraq.
The Russians are certainly much closer in a territorial sense. And I think there is some Russian concern, particularly particularly they had the Russians had concern about potential Iranian support for more Islamist based dissidents and separatists inside Russia. For example, Russia's breakaway province of Chechnya, which has produced a lot of Chechen fighters who have terrorized Russians. The Russians have been very concerned that Iran or others would support the Chechens against Russia and pose this kind of security threat. But the Russians are smart, and they deal pretty intelligently with the Iranians. And what they've done is they've essentially struck a deal with the Iranians, that the Iranians don't support the rebels in Chechnya. They've essentially made that deal. The Iranians don't support the basically some of the Islamist challenges and separatists within Russia and the former Soviet Union. And the Russians are looking at Iran for a whole series of deals and give and take, which they do back and forth. The Russians, I think, would like to and are probably very close to being able to coordinate with Iran for the export of its natural gas, which could give Russia even more geostrategic leverage and weight if they could control not only their own oil and gas, but Iran's oil and gas. So the Russians are playing a very smart game and I think are doing very well in their relationship with the Iranians.
Mm-hmm. What would bring forth to the light of day serious discussion about all of this on the part of Congress, on the part of the American people? It seems to me as though after all these years in Iraq, where things are not going very well, that the American public would like to know what's going on, Hillary.
Yeah, I think there certainly is a tremendous desire to know what's going on and to have a better understanding of what could make us safer in terms of our
right.
physical security, our energy security, our economic security. Unfortunately, I think we've seen, though, it's been taken to a by orders of magnitude by the Bush administration in terms of, in my view, being a bit irrational dealing with the Iranians. But we have a long history of real problems that are from both the Democratic and Republican side in terms of dealing with Iran that has really eclipsed our ability to see that since 1989, since the death of the initial spiritual leader and founder of the Iranian Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, that there has been a change in terms of Iran's posture and ability to deal geopolitically on the international stage. From the overthrow of the Shah in 1979, that was really included a very serious anti-American component, of course, with the seizure of our U.S. diplomats in Tehran. From 1979 until 1989, Iran was really in a revolutionary state and was looking to destabilize many countries and be pretty anti-American around the world. But from 1989 until today, we've seen an Iran that is increasingly interested and able to act on its national security interests, its interests as a nation state rather than as a radical Islamic revolution, and has legitimate security interests that it tries to put forward. We need, I think, in the next administration, I don't think it's possible in this administration, but from the next administration, I think what we need is someone who, with a real clear-eyed understanding of that, that you can deal with Iran in a strategic sense to really reexamine that relationship and to try to deal with Iran as a strategic country with legitimate national and security interests. That's going to be something that's very, very hard to do. And unfortunately, I think the rhetoric now from all sides is focused on whether or not you sit down and talk to a Hitler-like personality they term the Iranian leader. But, you know, we've seen the Bush administration do that with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, even though he blew 280 Americans out of the sky. We've seen the Bush administration do that with North Korea, and we saw the Nixon administration do that with China. And I think each of those decisions, as hard as they were, required real leadership to say to the American people that as despicable as those leaderships have been, that we cannot, you know, just as we couldn't ignore the fact that there are 1.8 billion Chinese people and just wish them away, we're not going to be able to wish away 80 million Iranians. And we need a way to figure out how to deal with this critically important country in a strategic way that gets beyond our emotional disappointment and displeasure with some of their tactical choices.
Mm-hmm. Rick from Milwaukee, hi.
Yes, good morning. You've already dealt with, or at least indirectly dealt with, the issue of the price of gasoline for U.S. consumers. I think the implication was it would go through the roof like we have never seen it in this country. So I'll skip that part. I'm wondering, though, two things. One, just the fact that U.S. commandos are now inside Iran, isn't that objectively an act of war by the United States? And secondly, how in the U.S., how can we, and in fact, how can the Israelis deal with the hypocrisy of their having somewhere between 150 and 500 nuclear weapons of their own, when at the same time Iran has zero nuclear weapons and doesn't even have, isn't even implementing a design of a weapon?
Thank you. Two very important points from the caller. The issue of whether or not there are U.S. commandos inside Iran, again, I can't testify to that as a fact or not, though I do think there is credibility to the news reporting on that. His characterization of could or should the Iranians take that as an act of war, absolutely. I'm trained as a lawyer and spent many years in international law, and certainly that could be seen, and probably would objectively be seen as an act of war. And this is where my concern is pretty acute, is that the Iranians will see it as an act of war and will prepare to act in response to that, either by trying to seize, either the Americans if they're crossing into Iran, or surrogates that we may be dealing with, whether they're Iraqi or Iranian dissidents, and we could see. We could see some serious repercussions, and then we could see the Iranians even up the ante, and as I talked about before, triggering their international network to start terrorist attacks against the U.S. and our allies, and of course to target our troops inside Iraq. So it is a serious concern. The hypocrisy of other countries, particularly in the region, including the Israelis, having a nuclear program, while we're so concerned about Iran having a nuclear program, is a real problem for the Israelis, for the United States, for the Middle East, and for the future of the nonproliferation regime that does need to be really dealt with in a strategic way by the next administration. Again, I think it's too late for this administration, for the Bush administration, and I think the Bush administration has lost too much credibility to actually deal with this problem in the comprehensive strategic way that it needs to be dealt with. The caller, I think, points to a really important issue here. The question, the future for nonproliferation. If we continue to focus on some countries like Iran, but not other countries like not just Israel, but India and Pakistan, who tested nuclear devices outside of the nonproliferation control regime set up by the international community. We focus on some countries, but not others. That gets into deciding who we like today should have a nuclear weapon. If we don't like them tomorrow, they shouldn't have it. That is not a way to promote security for the U.S., our allies, or for the international community. Something I think that Barack Obama has said he would take on during his administration, but many people have also said it's important to take on, and they haven't. So one hope I would have is that this issue may focus our attention on the need to do that in the next administration, but it's a hard, hard, hard thing to do.
Yeah. Another email from Dave from Menominee, Michigan. With John McCain's lack of economic knowledge, do you think our military or the Israeli military will attack Iran in hopes of affecting our elections in November?
That McCain would try to attack Iran in hopes of affecting the relationship here?
The military, in order to get McCain elected, would attack because that's an issue that fares well for the Republicans.
I think one of the fascinating things being here in Washington and having worked in the Bush administration is to see who supports what inside the administration. Mm. And certainly under Secretary Rumsfeld, you could have had some really questionable decisions. I wouldn't say exactly this kind, but some really really questionable decisions taken. But I think Secretary Gates, our Secretary of Defense now since 2006, is someone who is really clear-eyed and focused on U.S. national security interests and not political interests. He is, I think, one of the leading advocates within the administration, along with some of the uniformed military, like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, who both are cautioning very seriously against military action against Iran, that the repercussions, the blowback to the United States, to our 150,000 troops there, would be too significant and too destabilizing mm-hmm. for us to undertake. So, interestingly, in the divided Bush administration that we have, the tables have actually moved a little bit. The chairs have moved a little bit, where you now have the military, both the Secretary of Defense, right. and some of the key uniformed military actually arguing against mm-hmm. a military strike. And then you have those that are arguing, I think, continue to argue for a military strike, focused more in the Vice President's office.
Mm-hmm.
So not really from the military side. But unfortunately, I think for many of us here in the United States, as well as in Iran, you know, when you hear like someone like one of McCain's key advisors say that actually a terrorist attack on the
right.
U.S. actually would play well for McCain, that, of course, that's going to fuel the speculation not only here amongst us as Americans, but unfortunately, I think both in Israel and Iran, among people who don't understand the U.S. as well, and potentially could add to their arguments, either to support a strike against Iran from the Israeli side or on the Iranian side to prepare in what they would see as a self-defensive way, but could increase the likelihood of conflict, because if you have Iranian forces on high alert, the risk of an accidental conflict increases significantly.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is interesting, once again, the difference of opinion in the administration. Secretary of Gates, of Defense Gates, evidently meeting with Democratic caucus in the Senate, according to this report in the New Yorker. Gates warning of the consequences if the Bush administration staged a preemptive strike, saying, "We'll create generations of jihadists and our grandchildren will be battling our enemies here in America." Everybody was stunned at this Democratic briefing, asked whether Gates was speaking for Bush and Vice President Cheney. The senator says, "Let's just say I'm here speaking for myself."
Yeah. It is. It's fascinating. You know,
uh-huh.
about a month ago, President Bush, in May, actually, the end of May, President Bush was in Israel for the 60th anniversary of the birth of Israel, and he gave this very startling speech to the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, where he labeled anybody who would talk to countries like Iran as appeasers, invoking this you know, pretty significant Holocaust imagery, that people who would be talking essentially to Hitler if they talked to the Iranian leadership. The very same day, Secretary Gates, Secretary of Defense Gates, was actually talking to a group of retired diplomats in the United States, saying that he thought that engagement with Iran would be a very useful thing to do, and there should actually be an increased dialogue. Particularly, these former diplomats could play a role in talking to other Iranian former and current diplomats to try to see where we could agree on a comprehensive rapprochement or a comprehensive reconciliation of our differences. So it was really dramatic to see our Secretary of Defense and our President giving such diametrically
yes.
different
right.
views on the the same week.
Yeah. More phone calls in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Iran and Israel and the United States. Reports surfacing that Israel is increasingly likely to attack Iranian nuclear facilities this year. And our guest is this part of the world and has worked in two administrations concerning events in this part of the world. Our guest is Hilary Mann Leverett, Chief Executive Officer of Strategic Energy and Global Analysis, which is a private consulting firm that provides clients with assessments of political risk in global energy and financial markets. She spent 15 years working for the National Security Council at the White House and the State Department. She was director for Afghanistan, Iran, and Persian Gulf Affairs on the National Security Council and associate director for the Near East. And at the State Department, Middle East expert for the Secretary of State's policy planning staff and political advisor on the Middle East, Sudan, and Central Asia. We There's a great deal of interest in this topic. We're just jammed with emails and phone calls, so don't worry, we'll do this topic again if we don't get to all of you today. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee, or the email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking. We spoke with him about his first book. Our guest is the author of From Baghdad to America, Life Lessons from a Dog Named Lava. Back to your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. Michael is next. Hi, Michael.
Good morning to you. Thank you. I'd like to develop a little bit of the point that the previous caller made, and that is the nuclear weapons of Israel, that your guest pointed out the hypocrisy of it. But more than the hypocrisy of it, there's the destabilizing nature of these nuclear weapons, which Israel has, which acts as an incentive for other countries feeling that they need them. And that in a related issue is the Palestinian issue and the Israelis. Under the present Israeli government, as well as previous governments, without resolving this Palestinian issue, and it does not seem that there is any just or fair way that the Israeli government has gone about this, you will continue to have a destabilizing situation there due to Israel. The last point I wish to make is with regard to the U.S. as a destabilizing force, and hasn't been any talk of this, but like the U.S. has close to 250,000 people in the Middle East, and I haven't seen that there has been any stability because of it. You look what the U.S. has done in Iran during the Shah regime, as well as the invasion of Iraq. Has that brought any stability? I can't say that it has at all. And I think there has to be a total revamping of not just U.S. foreign policy, but of the Israeli policy in the Middle East. And I'd appreciate your guest comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. The caller just bring up, again, some very important points. The destabilizing effect of nuclear weapons in the region is important. From my, I negotiated with the Iranians for 2 years directly for the U.S. government over Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, and Iraq. But one thing that came out over and over again was in terms of their planning for the potential of a nuclear program and for their support of what we see of these terrorist groups, is that they needed those types of what they saw as kind of protection for their regime. On the nuclear side, it wasn't just the threat that they saw, though, from Israel's possession of nuclear weapons, but from Pakistan's possession of nuclear weapons. So the problem of other countries having a nuclear program that's not really declared, that's not really monitored, that's not under any kind of inspection regime, any kind of security regime, is a real problem. It's not, I would say it's not limited to Israel's possession of nuclear weapons, though certainly in the core of the Middle East, that's the biggest problem, but also for Pakistan and for others. And I think the important thing is not to focus on whether Iran should have to suspend its nuclear enrichment, this piece of its program. But how do we bring countries really firmly into a transparent inspection regime that that we have through the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, so that you have inspectors there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, like you have in Japan or Canada, so that the program is not really susceptible to a military use and could be used maybe more for nuclear energy. The other point about the Arab-Israeli conflict being a destabilizing variable in the Middle East is certainly an important one, and I think it is critically necessary for us to work with all of the players in the region, the Israelis, the Arab states, the Iranians, to try to put together a regional system of security and cooperation that tries to resolve these conflicts, not just tamp them down, but really to resolve these conflicts in a way that does not resort to force or military action. That is something I think is very doable, but this administration has really not put any effort into doing something like that. The third point from the caller is the U.S. presence in the region. It's problematic, of course, because there's conventional wisdom, I think, here in Washington, that having the U.S. presence does add security. But that is a very that's a questionable basis for us to proceed in terms of our national security interests. One of the most controversial points on this has been written about by a professor, Robert Pape, out of the University of Chicago, who's constructed this enormous database on the causes of suicide terrorism. And it looks into a lot of why does Al-Qaeda do what it does, essentially.
We have about 10 seconds.
Okay. And the basic point, though, is that it's this concern about a U.S. foreign Western military presence in the Persian Gulf or in Arab or holy Islamic places that prompts these people to actually try to blow themselves up.
Okay, on that note, we have to stop. You need to return. You're terrific. Thank you for all of your analysis. Thanks. Hilary Mann Leverett, Chief Executive Officer of Strategic Energy and Global Analysis. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. John Anderson for on-air production will return following the news.